Welcome to Movie Geeks United. We got a lot of great movie talk coming right up, but first, our feature guest for the evening is actor Justin Kirk. You might remember him from Angels in America, the high-profile HBO miniseries, or the equally high-profile Showtime series Weeds. He has a new film titled Last Love that co-stars Michael Caine and Gillian Anderson. And Dean had an opportunity to speak with Justin briefly last week, and here is that interview.
I would like a ham and cheese baguette to go with the pickle on the side.
Je ne comprends pas, monsieur.
Pourquoi les Américains font toujours comme si dans les autres pays, il fallait que tout le monde parle leur langue? Soyez un peu moins arrogant, hein?
Thank you.
Sometimes you meet someone who requires all the love you have to give.
Now speak after me. J'ai faim.
Je t'aime.
And if you lose that someone, you think everything else is going to stop too.
Merde, regardez où vous allez.
Ça va, monsieur? Would you maybe like me to walk you home?
It's not far.
I'm a teacher.
So am I.
What do you teach?
Philosophy. And you?
Cha-cha.
Your hair, it's so like my wife's hair.
Well, I hope you like your wife.
I did.
She died. 3 years, 2 months, and 11 days ago.
What are you doing with my dad?
I'm his friend.
He hasn't told me a word about you.
He hasn't told me a word about you either. I thought you didn't have anyone. You know, like I don't have anyone.
I'm a lousy father.
Stop acting like you're the only one who lost her.
It starts off kind of as what you think is going to be sort of a lighter kind of May-December romance kind of thing, and then
and then
when your character comes in, it sort of turns, you know, noticeably darker in some ways, and that's because your character is playing the son of Michael Caine in the film, and you've had kind of a troubled past, but the movie also like kind of keeps its cards close to its chest and doesn't reveal a lot about that past, at least at first. I was interested to know how you built the character and how you built a backstory for the character.
Yeah, they have a complicated relationship, those two, and I think the most is kind of said. There's a scene where he sits down, where Michael Caine's character sits down with Clemence and talks about how he really never desired to be a father. He did it for the woman that he loved, who wanted children, and never necessarily grew into knowing how to sort of do it. How he felt was the way to do it. And yet, there's this grown up person, being me, who you now have some sort of relationship with. So I think all of the characters, have lost people or have struggled with relationships that they have, and they're all kind of lonely and looking to find different connections with the others.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested to know, one of my, of course, Michael Caine's one of the great actors, and I still remember watching a sort of an acting class that he did for movies.
Yeah, I remember that too. It was a book and a video.
Yes, exactly. And that's one of the greatest acting pieces about acting I've ever seen. Did you was there anything specific that you learned from him by working with him?
Well, if I remember correctly, and I saw it when I was much younger, the video, and it was, he had a lot of very no-nonsense tips, you know, about specific to, like, screen acting in particular. But he's the kind of guy that, you know, what you're learning is just comes through with osmosis. You get on set with him, and you, you know, look at each other in the eyes and start going, and then it's all there, you know. But he's better than ever. He's in pretty much every frame of that movie, and so he's working crew hours, and he was he didn't miss a beat. And then, you know, then you go back to the hotel at night and drink in the hotel bar and hear some great stories about John Huston and various Hollywood legends.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
That's what you hope when you sign on to do a job with someone like him, you know, and he didn't disappoint.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you hop back and forth between movies and a lot of TV work as well. Is there any sort of specific sort of differences between acting for movies and acting for TV? Like, you know, because I notice while I'm watching TV that there's a TV work, there's a specific sort of number of beats and everything that needs to be in a specific amount of time, and movies don't really conform to that number of beats, really, at least some.
That's a very interesting thing to point out. I would say that is getting, the lines between the two are becoming less and less as television becomes kind of a different thing. If you look at shows now like Louie or Girls, those are shows without those beats, which I find really exciting, that bring a
mm-hmm.
kind of independent film sensibility to the world of television. And, you know, I don't have to tell you things are changing to the degree. I mean, obviously a lot of people are going to watch Last Love on the same box that they watch Weeds on. And, you know, it's I think there is less and less difference. And maybe in a certain amount of years there'll be no difference. I don't know. But no, in terms of my job, the only difference is sometimes the TV job will go on for a while and you'll get a new script every week, as opposed to 100 pages of text that you spend 2 months doing. So that's really mm-hmm. the only difference. But otherwise, also most of the movies I have done have been, you know, I've never been in a $100 million Transformers style thing, so I've never had the experience of spending 3 days working on the same scene, you know. So it's, it moves at a decent clip, and so it's been similar.
Well, is that something, you know, being in something really huge and unwieldy, like a huge $200 million blockbuster, is that something that you want to do, or are you specifically, you know?
I want to do, I'm all for doing whatever. That would be an interesting experience, and sure, I'd love to do that. I think it would be a challenge, actorially, just what I said, the idea of, like, spending days on one scene I think would be tough. I like to, move on to the next once you're through it. So,
mm-hmm.
Hopefully there's some $200 million blockbusters in my future.
I know you just signed on onto work on The Blacklist.
Got home yesterday.
Oh, okay. So, are you going to be a regular on this show?
I was trying to pitch that. I had such a great time there that I was trying to figure out how that might work. Alas, I am the bad guy of the week. So, it's, who knows if we'll see. I would be thrilled to come back. The thing about that one, when that offer came in, I was watching the show, like clearly many other people in America are. big James Spader fan since my youth, and so I was digging the show, and so when it came in, I was like, yeah, I'll go do that. But I was just there for the one, for the time being.
I noticed a quote on your IMDb page that that said that this was attributed to you, said that you spent a lot of your earlier years, at least in films, playing sort of angelic characters, and then finally you got to morph into somebody who's
right.
Well,
yeah, I feel like I know which quote you're talking about. I don't remember saying that. I probably did. But I do actually now finally feel like I may be moving on to my to the bad guy phase of my career, which is totally cool.
Okay, that was Justin Kirk. The movie is called Last Love. It is currently in limited release and available on video on demand. So thank you, Justin, so much for spending time with us.
Star Wars has a release date. There has been a lot of talk recently about when Episode 7 was actually going to hit theaters. We'd heard that due to screenwriter Michael Arndt leaving the project, J.J. Abrams and co-writer Lawrence Kasdan might be scrambling a bit to get the movie finished by 2015. Lucasfilm head Kathleen Kennedy had put in a request to Disney to see if they could push the release date to 2016. However, Disney was not having it and insisted that Star Wars hit theaters sometime in 2015. Well, I feel like there might have been a compromise somewhere in those discussions, because it looks like Star Wars Episode 7 will be hitting theaters late in 2015, and specifically on December 18th, 2015, just in time for the holidays.
Would it have been smarter to wait another year, as a lot of people have been suggesting, wait till the summer of 2016? Because now you are rushing. You are under the gun.
Should be under the gun no matter what the date is. You got to pick
a
date.
No, but I mean, you don't even have a script. You fired the guy who was writing the script. They're basically going back from scratch. You have basically 2 years, and you are taking the holiest of properties that's been defamed by its own creator over the last decade, and you already have an uphill battle as it is. How should I say, critically at least, maybe not financially, but critically, but you're taking, I mean, someone already came up with what the plot may be, and it's rather disturbing, but it sounds about right. It's because the casting notices they sent out to you, they want young, unknown male and female leads, and I got to say, I mean, you only got 2 years and 1 month to get this out, and it's not looking good.
Well, we should say the leads that they're looking for, they're putting out a casting call in various cities, including Chicago and Nashville and someplace in Iowa or whatever, but they're looking for two young people, one a female whose character's name is Rachel. Street smart, athletic, independent, natural beauty, all ethnicities, and multi or biracial.
Can I say something, though? When you doesn't the young adult craze, and in, I mean in a good way, like the Hunger Games and Divergent and the Mortal Instruments, doesn't it put this casting call seems almost passé?
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't it seem like that Star Wars is now, which was the front runner before 1999?
Now it's a follower and not a front runner.
Well, it's following. I mean, let's be very honest. It's following of all of them right now. Marvel is the thing that they're all following with their grandmaster plan, with the Avengers films and the tie-ins to all that. They're all following Marvel. They all want something as successful as that, which every film is interconnected. Everything builds to the next week. That's become obvious that Marvel, ironically, who had the worst film track record before 1998, they couldn't even get them released in theaters. They went straight to video. Is that, you know, I find it very interesting that, you know, the Avengers sort of really beat all these films at their own game. That's
the same studio behind the Marvel movies or behind the Star Wars movies. I think the Star Wars can easily take back the reins because it's Star Wars. But also, I think that they'll get it done in time because they do have a skeleton of a script that they're probably going to take off from. And most major studio tentpole movies always have multiple writers attached to them.
I don't doubt that.
They're already building bottles. They're already undertaking special effects work on it. So it's not like they haven't started yet. They're casting unknowns. I think that's much better than casting, you know, the latest teenage Selena Gomez part.
I agree. That's the best thing you could do. You don't want to put although is Harrison Ford really attached to all three of them?
Well, we don't know that yet. They haven't really
Said that there's a thing that was posted a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if it's true. He demanded that he be in all three of them, but on the condition that Indy 5 happens. That's like saying, I want diarrhea and I want to go to Dachau. I mean, you know.
Well, Indiana Jones would happen no matter what if Lucas and Spielberg are ready for it to happen. He's just being coy about whether or not he's going to be involved in this first Star Wars movie, but chances are he probably will. But, you know, the other thing is that it moved its release date from the usual May to December, and they did that to allow them a few more months' time. But they also like the idea that the release date they chose is the Avatar release date.
Lord of the Rings.
Well, no, they like the symmetry of the highest-grossing movie ever made being released on the exact same day that they're being released. I think December's probably might be a good time for them.
Don't see why not.
Another thing that's much different is you're not going to have the opening fanfare, the 20th Century Fox fanfare at the beginning of the Star Wars movie that we're so accustomed to.
True. I mean,
because it's not a Fox movie.
Oh, yeah,
that
would be weird.
Won't it be?
Yeah. And it'll also
be weird having the Star Wars film like in the wintertime because you're kind of used to them being summer movies.
No, but that's actually not. I mean, going back to the first Lord of the Rings film, in the Lord of the Rings film, I mean, I think that's the model. It's like Peter Jackson and obviously Avatar. And, you know, what's really going to be interesting, forget that. I'm really curious what the Avatar 2 is going to be like, to be honest with you. I know not you, Dean. I realize that. I realize of all the things, that's not the thing keeping you up at night. I'll be honest, it's not keeping me up at night at all. I didn't really walk out of Avatar thinking I wanted a sequel. I thought it was
deal. Here's something that's so curious about the Avatar movies, though. I mean, my great friend Rick, he's kind of sour on James Cameron. And he's just waiting for him to fail. And he really thinks that with Avatar 2, he could easily fail. And his thinking is, you know, I don't know anybody that's looking forward to Avatar 2. But you mention Avatar 2 and they'll always roll their eyes. I personally don't know anyone that wants to see it either. Then again, I don't know anyone that really liked the first Avatar, and yet they went to go see it 3 or 4 times. So I don't know.
I don't know either. I think it's very hard to tell. I would never root for anybody to fail, though. I don't want anybody to fail because I wouldn't want anyone to root me to fail. That's interesting, though. You know, the idea of a Star Wars being released in the wintertime is a new thing. I mean, forget everything else. The idea that you would release it in December, I really do wish that we lived in a parallel universe where the three films were looked upon and that was it. I really do. Because I remember George Lucas wasn't even interested in filmmaking anymore in the early 90s. Remember, he could care less. He didn't want to hear a Star Wars mentioned ever again, and then they made the Jurassic Park film and that changed everything for him. So thank you, Spielberg, for doing that for us.
Well, the fact that Lawrence Kasdan is involved again is a positive, as we've said before. You know, there's no – I'm willing to wipe the slate clean. It really doesn't
Oh, yeah. I mean, the idea that you could – look, I mean, the only problem with this film right now, there's only one drawback. It's also its greatest asset, but its greatest weakness is J.J. Abrams. because he loves the material so much. That's the only problem with the film. It's good and it's bad. So we just have to.
No,
we have
but
to
listen,
really
listen though. He loves the original three films, and that's something that it seems that George Lucas lost before he did the next three installments. So, and that was the main complaint about the new three. So if somebody returns back to that love of the original three, then
mm-hmm.
I think that's what fans will be more attentive to.
Well, I think they'll be attentive to that, but let's not forget something. Another thing is that there's also a whole another younger generation that loves the prequels too. That younger
yeah.
generation that drives toys and books
well,
and video
well,
game sales. Well, but I'm not going to say that. Look, I'm not crazy about them. But look, we also can I say something else? The reason maybe we didn't like them, we grew up. Let's put it. I also want to throw that out in the mix. Let's not forget adulthood has something to maybe do with that as well.
I don't know about that.
The first one is a boring film. I mean, you would have wished
yeah.
they sold Natalie Portman in the prostitution.
They got better. They got better as they went along. But I think I don't think it has anything to do with that. I just don't.
No,
think
the third one. The third one is
yeah.
good. But no, the first one is just a really bad movie. I mean, it's boring. It has really very little going for it in the first half. The second one is, but, you know, it's the third one at least has a lot of the iconic things that we wanted to see, I guess, in all those first two, and it does get better. But I think Jamie's right. Maybe because J.J. Abrams loves the original trilogy so much, that will hopefully catapult this into a whole new territory.
In Cannes this year at the Cannes Film Festival, I saw a film called All Is Lost, starring Robert Redford. And only starring Robert Redford. There are no other actors in this movie. It is simply a one-man show, and it is a remarkable tour de force performance from Redford, even at the age of 77, proving that he is at the top of his game as an actor. Really, he's never been better. And this could actually bring him that long overdue Oscar as Best Actor. There are very few actors who actually can hold the screen for 2 hours and keep us interested. Redford does that.
This is the Virginia Gene with an SOS call. Over.
You actually saw All Is Lost, right?
Yeah, I saw it a couple of weeks ago. I mean, wow. It's this Best Actor race is really heating up.
Well, performance-wise, how is it in relation to other Redford performances? I mean, does it feel like he's revealing something new?
Yeah, because, I mean, he doesn't have anyone, you know, it's definitely not the bumper sticker movie. This is probably the first Robert Redford movie that you couldn't say is the bumper sticker movie, as you like to say. There's very little dialogue. I mean, I actually think The Road Warrior has more dialogue in it than this, but it's a really awesome film, and I don't think the ending is clear-cut at all. I think you could spend years talking about the meaning of the ending. So it's not an open-ended at all, but I think it's a magnificent film, and it really ties in. I think it was A.S. Scott wrote an article in the New York Times. Someone from the New York Times wrote about, like, this, Captain Phillips and Gravity, there's this sense of, like, survival at the movies this fall. Like, this, mm-hmm. I mean, that's really, and you could throw in 12 Years a Slave, I think, into the mix as well.
Exactly, yeah, for sure.
But Redford's performance is magnificent. I mean, just the difference between this and something like The Company You Keep is night and day. It's an astounding performance, and I'm glad that he's, you know, this is what I guess Coppola was talking about with De Niro and Pacino in that article in GQ a couple of years ago. I mean, he has really challenged himself, taken himself outside his comfort zone with a movie like this. It's very rare to see that in this day and age with this generation of actors, but I got to hand it to him. I mean, kudos.
Well, that's good. It's good that he's, you know, if he gets back on top again in terms of performance, it's good that a Sundance alumni is the one that made that happen. I think there's a nice poetry in that.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's an indie movie itself and so forth, which I think, you know, might be one of his few independent productions.
You think about all the people that he's helped. over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a whole movement of people, and none of those people have ever offered him a role. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah,
true.
It is amazing, actually. It is pretty astounding, you know. But,
I mean, I would have loved to have seen him in Cop Out.
Okay. I would have camped out for that. Yeah.
Oh.
Well, of course, his next movie now after All Is Lost is going to be his first superhero movie, which is the Captain America sequel. So,
well, you got to pay the bills.
Everything comes back around to superheroes these days. You just can't get away from them.
It does seem like a curiosity for him, though. I mean, because I think he just wants to know what it's like to be in one of those movies. And that's why he did it. Like when he did the movie Spy Game, his thinking was, I just want to know how Tony Scott shoots his movies. And he was looking around when they were doing the rooftop scene with Brad Pitt, and he was just amazed. He said, like, Tony Scott has cameras up in the helicopters flying over the rooftop. It's got cameras everywhere. He was, just, you know, this very kind of emotionally direct. Film director on his own, of his own right, very simple, was like, well, all these pyrotechnics, they're like amazing.
Right.
And completely antithetical to how I do things. But so, yeah, it's going to be an interesting award season between, pronounce his name, Dean, from 12 Years a Slave.
Chiwetel Ejiofor.
And Robert Redford. See, I can handle the Robert Redford. I can pronounce that very well.
Don't let Chiwetel's name scare you.
No. I mean, I think that's who it's going to...
As long as you know
where
the accents go, you know, it's okay.
That could be between the two of them.
It's a two-man race at this point, right? Do you think?
Well, I mean, you know, it depends on McConaughey. I definitely want to see...
You have to put McConaughey...
We watched
it yesterday, and you have to put him and Jared Leto both. I mean, it's a performance-driven movie.
I think Leto is like really in the lead for his category, but I think it's still going to be Robert Redford. Just the idea of Robert Redford going up there. It doesn't matter how successful people are trying to tear down All Is Lost because it's not successful at the box office. But that doesn't really matter in the acting categories. I mean, hell, just a couple of years ago, they gave Meryl Streep one for Iron Lady. Nobody was going to see that. So,
No, that's true.
So just the whole idea of Robert Redford being up there, he'll be the oldest actor to ever win the award, even older than Henry Fonda was when he won for Golden Pond. And just that whole as a career award, and not only that, though, it's a movie that's worthy of a Best Actor.
Yeah, he's finally done it.
Oh, it is worthy of it, but I wouldn't rule out. I got to give McConaughey for Dallas Buyers Club, but more importantly for Mud, just two really knockout roles in one year. And this is a guy people had written off many years ago because he just kept doing it. I'm going to be in every movie that Kate Hudson is in, play opposite her. And he's really come around, really given his all, and I would not rule him out for either one of these.
The thing about GF4's performance, I want to say this. There's a lot of people out there who are also kind of criticizing that performance for being rather limited, but you also have to remember that the character's emotions have to be kept in check all throughout. Bad things can happen to him. So he's not living the life of a normal person. And
let's not forget Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks. He's definitely in the race and so forth. So, and I think we might have Bruce Dern in there as well.
Bruce Dern is I would say a given.
There's a few others in there that might sneak in over him. Because there is some controversy
about him, his being either a lead performance or a supporting performance, and the actor himself demanded that he be put in lead because he didn't want to, you know, want to cheat his way to a win supporting when it was really a lead, you know.
Right, right.
Kind of a,
no, but I mean, I wouldn't rule that out.
That's kind of they do these days, but yeah. Yeah, I mean, me neither. Yeah, I mean, considering that he won the Best Actor at Cannes and everything.
He could very easily be the fifth nominee. But, you know,
and
like
we,
every
we
year.
Don't, inside
like
Llewyn Davis, I wouldn't rule that out. Someone's got to get it for that. I mean.
I think screenplay and cinematography and music, for sure. And
no, not music, because none of the music will be nominated because none of the music is entirely original. So there's
oh,
no,
I thought they wrote
no
one, with one original song for it.
Nope.
But let me ask you guys this, though. Let me ask you guys this, though. Because we do have some, you know, there is a big, big movie. I mean, it's not, I don't know, not critically maybe, not, let's not rule out Gatsby. Gatsby could find some, you know, when we get up and watch those nominations, I wouldn't be surprised to see, I mean, DiCaprio is getting a nomination for either this or Wolf of Wall Street.
I don't think so.
Right. I would not rule it out. Gatsby has its fans.
Well, I know it does, but I think Gatsby you'll see a lot of nominations in the technical categories for sure.
Well, that,
but,
that thing has costuming won right now, I think.
Oh yeah,
costuming,
direction, maybe even special effects, you know, if you realize there are a lot of effects.
We don't. I mean, supporting the actor. You know, you're right about Jared Leto. I mean, I would say he's a. But I mean, let's not forget about Blue Jasmine, and let's not forget about Andrew Dice Clay. Andrew Dice Clay could get a nomination, and deservedly so.
I think he
Blue
deserves
Jasmine.
One personally. I
yeah.
It is one of the most memorable supporting performances I've seen this year by an actor. And I mean, of course, you know, you're going to get Fassbender in there, but then after Fassbender and Leto, it gets a little murky in there.
Well,
like,
let me ask you guys this though.
You know, maybe Gandolfini gets in.
Oh, Gandolfini's got to get in, and
by
you know,
the way,
enough.
I think there's going to be a surprise nomination, and it's going to be for Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I'm feeling that in the wind now.
I don't think it's a surprise.
I think she's going to get in there and she's going to knock out, like, Emma Thompson or
well, let me ask you guys this, though. There's one movie, there's a big movie that comes out Christmas Day, not Wolf of Wall Street, not Grudge Match. I know you're all looking forward to Grudge Match, but August Osage County. We cannot rule out this movie. This movie has Oscar desire all over it.
The only problem is it's not getting that kind of real love. It's kind of being labeled as kind of a stagey movie. I'm kind of putting this movie in that same category as like, and I've got to go back to the 80s now, but Crimes of the Heart or something like that. Pulitzer Prize winning movie has Oscar written all over it, but when it comes out, really only gets two nominations or whatever.
Right, no, of course.
You know, so,
that's possible.
Or something like All the King's Men, which if you looked at All the King's Men, the remake, and you saw that cast and that Steven Zalian was behind it, and it looked like it had prestige written all over it, and that was the most bland milquetoast movie you've ever seen.
Yeah, and it's sad, though. It couldn't compare. I mean, Sean Penn couldn't hold a candle to Broderick Crawford in that role. I mean, he just couldn't do anything. No one could do anything with that movie to really even compare to the original or the book. I mean, just really sad given all the talent involved with it. But
we still think Kate Blanchett is a front runner for
I think for a Woody Allen film of this
Plug
magnitude,
fest.
Yes.
Slugfest between her and Bullock.
Oh yeah, we can't
come right down to the wire.
Mm-hmm.
It'll come right.
And
down
we can't
to the
rule
wire.
Out Gravity for that for her. I mean, Gravity you've got to keep in there.
You know, I think.
There are some other things that are interesting. I mean, I do. You know, American Hustle maybe just given that the Oscars do like David O. Russell's last two films.
So you do have to keep, I mean, I haven't read anything one way or good or bad
still,
about it
American
yet.
Hustle, I mean, I read about the first 6 minutes that they screened last night, and they said that those first 6 minutes were hysterical, and they had a very fast-paced, whirling camera, Scorsese-esque kind of feel, and great 70s pop songs, and it looks like really colorful performances from everyone involved, especially Christian Bale. I think that you're going to see a couple of supporting performances from American Hustle nominated, probably. I think that's pretty much a safe bet, especially as flashy as those parts seem to be and how much fun they're having playing them. But there's pluses and minuses with every – like if you go back to Best Actor – you can say that Ejiofor, you know, it's not only the central performance of this very powerful movie, but it's representative of a movie that whose time has come, that handles the issue better than any other movie ever has, and then so that's a plus on his side. Then you can say all the pluses about Redford, and I think Bruce Dern's story is a little bit too much. Tied in with Redford's, you know, the older veteran coming back with a powerful performance out of nowhere, you know. So I think Redford definitely has the edge over Dern in that respect.
What about
and then McConaughey?
We'll
talk about that in a second. Then McConaughey is a. I mean, obviously everyone loves his performance, but some people feel that it's overshadowed by Jared Leto's performance. And people are—they're not negative on the film, but they think, "Oh, it's a nice film." They're not over the moon about it necessarily.
It's a performance-driven movie. It's not—you know—it's not the kind of film. Having watched it yesterday, I'll be honest with you—it's more the performances that you're enthralled with than the actual filmmaking. If you were, and actually, it hit too close to home because that's my dad's medical practice. I mean, Matthew McConaughey and especially Jared Leto, those are the patients that my dad saw like the last 15 years of his practice. My mom really was tempted to walk out, I think, at one point because it hit too close to home. You know, she was less like, I mean, I remember because I only worked 2 summers for my dad, but it did remind me of that at times. I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that it's that authentic. But I hear what you're saying, Jamie. It's the performances that you go for a movie like that, that will be remembered when it comes to Oscar.
In terms of Fruitvale Station, you mentioned, I do think we're probably looking at an original screenplay for that, right?
Right, I think so. Maybe in a supporting actress for Octavia Spencer, but I just think the best actor thing for Michael B. Jordan is just too full. I don't see him making it. We should also mention too. The other night, they finally screened Out of the Furnace, the new film with, and it's getting incredible reviews. Where they're like comparing it to, you know. To Deer Hunter or something like that, you know. I mean, it's getting really, really strong reviews for everybody involved with it. So,
I wouldn't rule that out either.
Maybe that'll be a surprise that comes in. That's something that's not on a lot of. I mean, it is on the radar, but it's not on the awards radar very much, you know. Really, but it's possible that could come in too. One movie that had its award hopes dashed, I think, this weekend was also The Book Thief, which...
Oh, really? What, is it not getting good reviews, or...
Totally negative reviews, I mean, for the most part. I mean, I think the most positive thing that's being said about it has to do with John Williams' score, which even that, they say, is a little derivative of the score he did for Schindler's List, but
they also say it's very saccharine. That's what I'm hearing about it.
Is that screened at AFI? Is that been screened? Was that screened at the AFI Fest? Or?
That's open.
I think it's actually gotten a release. Yeah.
It comes out on Friday. I know here. So I mean.
Well, I've read decent things about Saving Mr. Banks. I don't know if I mean, they're not over the moon enough to make you think that it would necessarily be up for Oscars, but I've read that it's a very, like, a three-hanky kind of...
I could easily see that getting in the picture.
I could see Emma Thompson. I could see Emma Thompson possibly being nominated for it.
Right.
Because she actually has the showcase part in it.
Right, right. And then, you know, Hanks for supporting actor, maybe, you know.
So we're looking at dual nominations for him.
Possibly.
Okay.
And you know, some technical awards, too, here and there. So, but it could, I think that has a strong possibility of getting in the Best Picture race as well. So,
do you think they'd nominate something like Blue is the Warmest Color for a picture?
No.
No, but is that, let me ask you this, is that the French language? Or no, that's not the French foreign best film for foreign
no,
language?
No, it's not the official entry in the French, for the French this year. So,
out of curiosity, what is?
I don't know at the moment. I don't have that at my fingertips, but...
Okay, no, I was just curious.
And I think one of the reasons is because... there was some kind of release date problem or something for it, so it wasn't necessarily a snub for the movie. It was just
let me ask you guys a question.
Kind of,
you know, we talked about a lot of the great directors. You know, we still have Scorsese, Russell, Spike Lee's old boy. I don't expect Spike Lee's old boy to get any kind of Oscar love because Spike Lee does not get Oscar love. But there's another film, though, that it has dropped off the radar, or I don't know when it's coming out, and that's the new Spike Jones movie.
Yeah.
Her. What is
that's
with that?
That's still being discussed. That's in the discussion in all the major categories, including actor and picture. Most controversially, I think they're going to launch a campaign for Scarlett Johansson for just her voice performance in it.
Mm-hmm.
For supporting actress, so that's probably...
That would be very interesting. That would be very curious. I mean, it looks fascinating. I mean, it looks like a fascinating movie, and I would love to see... You know, Joaquin Phoenix rightfully was nominated for The Master, and I'd just like to see him get his due. I mean, he may be the most interesting actor alive right now.
I think you're right on that.
I'm not there or whatever. I'm there or still here. I'm still here. I mean, it seems like he's in on this whole joke and everything, but he wants to be taken seriously. He doesn't want to be taken seriously, and his choices are really fascinating. He could have gone a totally different route, and the route he's taken is so interesting. I think Her, we saw a trailer for that yesterday, and I just haven't heard anything about it lately. When is it supposed to come out?
I think in December.
Okay. Well, December is really crowded, guys. I mean, December is really crowded.
So did you guys watch any movies this week that you really liked? I saw three movies this week that I wanted to comment on that were 2013 movies that were released earlier in the year, and they were all comedies. I watched, first I'll get the disappointment out of the way. I watched The World's End, and I was very, very disappointed with that film. I just felt like it had absolutely no laughs in it, nothing really surprising in it. I was really kind of bored by it.
I could see where you would say that. I mean, there was no, when we saw it in the theater, no one laughed.
Yeah, I mean, it was so different from Shaun of the Dead, or especially Shaun of the Dead, but also Hot Fuzz, which I thought was funny, but not as good as Shaun of the Dead.
No, I agree with you.
Was kind of
feeling, yeah. I liked it, but the more I thought about it, it wasn't something I walked out of and said, that was a really great movie. It was like, wow, there's something not gelling altogether.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that doesn't gel. When you more you think about it, you're like, oh, that is, it's funny and everything. But there are people who will come, it's like, it doesn't have, I guess, this, you know, I hate to say this, but maybe Scott Pilgrim, you know, he had something really going there, kinetic energy, and I guess it feels like a letdown after Scott Pilgrim, to be honest with you.
It does. It really does. It does. You're absolutely right on that. Because, I mean, that's a movie that's kind of a hodgepodge that actually works. Mm-hmm. This is a hodgepodge that doesn't work. Like, it's like, you almost, like, when the robots show up or whatever, you almost wish, like, the movie didn't have any of that in it and was just really a movie about these guys. And then
the robots show up and
sort of distract you from that whole story and everything. I mean, not that that story was incredibly, you know, compelling, but you know, I don't know.
But it was more interesting than going that route. I mean, there was something very telling about why some of these guys' lives went very well, and then obviously the main character's life was, you know, let's be honest, right in the ditch. But you're right. I actually thought I got to be honest with you. My mom hated it. She just didn't understand why the hell we were watching this. I liked it the more I thought about it. I can't say while watching it, this is the best thing I've ever seen. I was like, this is good, but there is something off about it.
I like Simon Pegg a lot, and this is mm-hmm. the first performance I've seen of his, including the ones in the Star Trek movies,
mm-hmm.
that I felt was kind of forced, I don't know, he's trying too hard or something, there's something amiss there, but I did see two other movies that I really liked, comedy movies that have absolutely no Oscar hopes, but they are really good movies, you should check them out. One was The To-Do List.
That movie was hysterical. Oh, my God.
That movie was great. It reminded me a little bit of, like, Easy A in just sort of like a surface way, but it was much rockier than Easy A was. Easy A was really ultimately kind of sweet, even though it was, you know, sexy and everything. But and this movie has a sweetness too, but it's above all, it is absolutely unflinching in its discussion.
It's a great vehicle for her, for Audrey Plaza. It was great, just like starring vehicle for her. She's hysterical in it. Everyone's good. Bill Hader was good. Everyone's good in that.
Very unusual casting of that character, casting Aubrey Plaza in that movie.
Yeah, it's not the first thing I would have thought of.
Yeah, not your typical. She's kind of an unusual kind of beauty to her, but just not your typical person that you would mm-hmm. go to in that kind of role. So that made it really fresh. I thought she was very good in it, and the script was excellent. And it was just a lot of fun. And then I don't want to spend too much time talking about this, but We Are the Millers was also pretty fun, you know.
Made me scared of spiders in my nuts.
Oh yeah, the spider scene. I like that film too. And you have to give credit. We have to give credit to Jennifer Aniston for doing a very, very sexy dance for us in that movie. I mean, she really did a good job on that. So, but other than that, I'm watching The Wire, finally getting through The Wire.
Oh, sweet. Awesome.
I'm in the middle of the second season, so.
Oh, wow.
It's fantastic.
Well, I saw two documentaries about film. One of the documentaries we'll be talking to the director of next week. So it was called Drew, the Man Behind the Poster, and it's about Drew Struzan. It's essentially one of the most, if not the most famous movie poster illustrator.
He's great.
So you're talking Star Wars movies and Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom and The Goonies, and he has a very distinct, almost photorealistic style, but the more you look at his posters, the more you realize they're actually hand-drawn, you know, but they look very photorealistic. And there's something about, like, if you think of the way he illustrates Harrison Ford and the Indiana Jones posters. It's almost like the idealized version of Indiana Jones. Like he had a way of illustrating movie posters to what the movie wants to be, like the ideal version of that movie, or something like Back to the Future, that iconic poster he made for that. So it's a really interesting documentary that we'll be talking more about next week, but it's well worth checking out. That comes on DVD, not next week, but the week after. And then I saw a documentary called Birth of the Living Dead, which is about, Night of the Living Dead and how it came to be and the legacy that followed. And it just feels like such worn material. You know, it's been covered to death, it feels like, you know, what that movie meant and what it started. But, you know, there was a point, there was an interesting thing and the stuff in there about the lead actor being African American, which is always something that's brought up about the movie, but they talked to a lot of people at that time that spoke about how shocking that was, and here was a actor who, you know, slapped a white woman in the middle of the movie, and electrified audiences at the time just watching that and what that represented. And how Romero didn't really think about race or the racial implications of the choice of that lead actor when he went with him. So it's fine, but there's nothing revelatory about it because it's been done to death already, I think.
That's very true.
Speaking of being done
to
death, and Dean, you're just going to have to grin and bear this part of the show.
I know what's coming. Oh, God.
So anyway, you know, we got to do something on JFK, since it's only makes sense. It's the 50th anniversary, and we're going to be inundated throughout the month with Kennedy lore.
So we're
putting on together a retrospective just on the movie. So only people that were involved in the movie are actually in the show. I'm not inviting anybody outside of the movie. But so far there's. I mean, we can replay the sections of Robert Richardson, Michael Rooker, and A. Kidman Ho.
Right.
Where they talk about JFK. And then we've got Sally Kirkland, who was in the movie. And then we've got Jim Mars, who the movie's book is based upon, his and Garrison's. And he was a consultant on the movie. So the big question mark is, are we going to get Oliver Stone? Look, I've tried to get this man for 7 years. I submitted an interview request to him months in advance, months ago. And I know that they say that they're trying, but something tells me they're going to fuck me over on it again. And if they do, for the first time ever, I am going to write back an incredibly nasty email to them.
You should. I mean, definitely. I mean,
yeah. I agree. I mean, especially considering that you've taken all of the right steps and so forth. I agree that you.
And he's doing every Tom, Dick, and Harry internet show out there, man. I mean, if you can
look, I'll be honest
all over
with
the place.
You, Jamie. I'll be honest with you. I'm bummed that we never got the Palma for Passion. I mean, we've had him on the show, which pisses me off. We had him on the show. We've done all these shows about his movies and everything, and you couldn't give it to him for Passion? I mean, I'm really pissed about that because I was waiting for your phone call or email that, hey, we got the Palma. Can you, you want to join in? And we never got that, and I'm really pissed. What more do we need to do? I mean,
yeah,
really?
We were not late getting to De Palma either. I mean, Dean planted the seed the year before, and then I got to publish this that handled Passion like way early, you know? So, I don't know. But with Oliver Stone, there's things that interest me, I'm sure I'm going to be talking about the assassination with Jim Mars, but not necessarily the assassination with Oliver Stone. I'm really interested in the filmmaking behind the experience of making that and The Doors in the same year, regardless of what you think of either movie. I don't like The Doors. I love JFK. But regardless of that, what kind of a Herculean task must that have been?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my God.
True.
Well, I mean, I got to be honest. I've read more, but I've read so many books. I've read a book by him. I've read so many books about Oliver Stone. I've read so many things about him. He's not my all-time favorite director or anything, but I'm always fascinated by him. I just think his life story is fascinating. His biography is fascinating. This is a guy who went to Vietnam, volunteered. Forget everything else. I mean, he volunteered to go to war.
He has a fascinating personal story, but also at a certain point in his career, he was one of our pretty much almost the most exciting American filmmaker in that.
Yeah.
His films in
the mid 80s.
His films provoked a response. And it was usually an extreme response on either side. And he's an extremely innovative filmmaker. I mean, a lot of the visual and editing techniques that he uses, and he writes things that are just these mammoth studies that how do you get your head around how to approach JFK? I mean, how to consolidate all those fucking crazy theories in one movie.
He's fearless.
Yeah.
I mean,
he was, definitely. I mean,
he does not shirk away from, I mean, he still isn't. I mean, the MLK movie is coming out. They're working on that. So, and, you know, even with his recent documentary thing, The Untold History of the United States, I mean, he still remains fearless, and I have to give him credit
to give him credit for that. I think, like I said, he's a very interesting director. He still is, and I got to say, Jamie, if we don't get him, then go let the dogs of war out on that one.
I agree, because I mean, you know, this show has never been anything else but supportive of his work, and if he can't, if no one's telling him that, or if the people in charge don't know, I mean, come on.
And also, he'll be in a show where a lot of other participants of the movie will be on. So we're actually making a whole show out of it. It'll piss me off, but we're going to find out within days. I mean, it's going to be next week when we find out whether or not we got him. And if it's a no, I'm going to be super fucking pissed.
rightfully so. I agree. But he really should be on the show. And goddamn, he did Jason O'Brien's show many, many years ago.
Don't forget, we're one of the few people on Twitter that he follows.
Yeah.
Like, what is that about?
I don't know.
I don't know. Anyway, so I ordered Parkland on VOD, and something happened. Like, it reached the one-hour point, and it stopped. And then it started over from the beginning. So I started fast-forwarding it, and it reached the hour point, and it stopped again. So I got cheated out of the last half hour of Parkland, and yet I paid for it.
See, that's what we have to deal with on VOD. See, that's the kind of thing kind of, like, hiccup.
Jerry, did you see Parkland?
No, I haven't seen Parkland. I have it on my Netflix queue when it comes out on Netflix to watch. I have not watched it yet.
It's, it's not by any means a great movie. But it doesn't really play like a TV movie, which I fully expected that it would, but it doesn't. It didn't for me. It's not that great because I think because you're following so many people, you don't feel that there's a core there that you can latch onto and care about to carry you through the whole movie because your attention's diverted and to everyone else. You know, if you think of JFK, the movie JFK, and there are 1,000 moving parts around Kevin Costner, but Kevin Costner is the constant and the center of that
right.
movie. I think there's no through line
in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But at the same time, it is about the little stories that aren't explored as much as the main event. So it brought to mind a couple of things. Like, first of all, it told me something that I didn't know. I didn't know Kennedy was still breathing when they brought him into the emergency room. There's no way that he could have been saved. But and then it got me to think about when they went to develop the film. They tried to develop the film right away, and they found this place where we could do that, and so this nervous guy is going to develop this film. this guy knows that he's about to develop probably the most important piece of film in the history of the world. Imagine the pressure of that, not to screw that up. So it's a movie like that. You can latch onto these little character moments that you might not have considered before. But other than that, it's pretty unexceptional.
I hate to say what it reminds me of from everything you guys are telling me and when I first heard about it on this show. It reminds me of this one about that Emilio Estevez did, Bobby, is what the only thing
right.
I could really think of. That's what it reminds me of. I mean,
anybody
yeah.
see Ruby, the one with Danny Aiello as Ruby?
I never watched that, I have to say.
Because that came out right on the heels of Stone's JFK.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
And
mm-hmm.
I remember the poster, the man who shot JFK, was the tagline, which was a great tagline. But I never did check that out.
Right.
Bill Murray's brother played Ruby in Oliver Stone's
JFK. That's right. Yeah.
And Oliver Stone, another thing that he does, he used comedians. I mean, John Candy played a dramatic role.
There were great. That was great choices. Yeah. That was just great choices all around in that one.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, one thing you can say about JFK is, you know, there's always something to look at in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's always something to capture your attention in the film. Whether it's the editing or the cinematography or the casting or some of the writing, it's you know, what are you gonna say? It's an effective movie.
Apparently, like, Walter Matthau came in to shoot his scene, and they're on a plane set. And Oliver Stone loved working with these veteran actors. He does a lot of his movies, whether it be Matthau and Lemon and Asner and JFK, or
mm-hmm.
somebody like Charlton Heston and Any Given Sunday. You know,
he loves
working with that generation. So Matthau comes in, and he takes a spot in the seat he's supposed to be in. And then Costner sits next to him, and Matthau doesn't know who the hell Costner is. This is great.
That is awesome.
I do love that.
Yeah. Anyway, so, yeah, JFK stuff throughout the month.
Hey, I had something I wanted to bring up.
Yeah.
What do you think about the casting of Emil Hirsch as John Belushi?
I think it's promising. I think it's a promising, bold choice. I mean, he's a good actor. I mean,
you can see him doing it.
That's not a stretch. I mean, I didn't want to go on Twitter and, like, start a jihad against it or anything, like with Ben Affleck as Batman. You know, I just thought, you know, it was a good – it made sense to me. It just didn't seem like something that was so out of left field. I mean, it just seemed like, hey, that's right. That seems
right.
Yeah,
I mean, he can gain a little bit of weight for the role. He's the right age. He gained a little bit of weight for the right role. He's got the right kind of face for it. It could really work, I think. You know, I don't know what to say about the movie or whatever, but
is this going
to
be based on the Widow's book, the Widow's biography, that coffee table book that came out a couple years ago?
I don't know if it's based on anything or not. So
okay.
I mean,
but it's approved by the Widow and Dan Aykroyd. Dan Aykroyd's producing it, I think.
Right. Exactly. And then also I have to bring up a couple more casting news things here. Tom Hardy as Elton John in Rocket Man. Is this possible? How is this possible? Well, first of all, isn't Tom Hardy, like, totally ripped and, like, huge? I mean, like, is he like a muscle guy?
He's a muscle guy, but he could definitely change. I mean, look what Christian Bale did for The Machinist, or look what Matthew McConaughey did for, I mean, these guys can do that. I mean, it's amazing what these actors will do for roles. I mean, the transformation. So I wouldn't put anything past Tom Hardy.
The one thing that makes Tom Hardy an odd choice for me is emotional. It's not physical. It's the fact that
right.
Tom Hardy is usually so incredibly reserved and monosyllabic mm-hmm. in all of his movies, but Elton John is a flamboyant guy.
He mumbles.
At least
too.
In performance.
I just think that's
kind of the for me. Tom Hardy being cast is kind of the polar opposite of the Emile Hirsch casting. It's like, okay, I can't see it. You're just gonna have to prove it to me.
Right, right.
You know, you're just gonna. I'm just gonna have to wait and see it. You know.
For whatever reason, Elton John loves that choice. I mean, he's totally on board with Thomas Hardy.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm anxious. You know, give me a great performance.
I'm curious. Yeah.
Yeah. He's an intriguing actor. I mean, he has an intriguing presence, and I don't know how to classify him yet. You know, I don't know what he's made of yet. Tom Hardy.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. We're still in the discovery phase there.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be something to watch, for sure.
It's time for our second guest interview of the evening, director Oliver Hirschbegel. His new film is titled Diana, and it's based on the life of Princess Diana, post-divorce to Charles. It stars Naomi Watts. It's currently in limited release. Oliver, of course, directed Downfall a few years back. That was majorly critically acclaimed. And
great movie.
Did he do The Invasion after that?
Like He did The Invasion, and then you know, because I mean, that was everyone directed The Invasion, though, wasn't that the thing? The Wachowski brother and sister did that too, right?
Right. Here is Oliver to tell us about his new film and what he learned about Princess Diana while making it.
The most famous woman in the world.
The Princess of Wales. We can all be thankful as we look forward to the future. Humanity's only defense against landmines is to stop manufacturing them. Thank you.
Dr. Hasnat Khan.
I feel like I can make a contribution.
Well, perhaps I can show you around. I don't know how to contact you.
Well, I'm like most people. I've got a mobile.
Did the script come to you through the regular channels, or did you help develop it at all?
It came to my agent, like the first draft of it. And as I said in interviews, I didn't really know anything about Diana in the first place and didn't really want to read it. But then he kind of pressured me to read it because Stephen Jeffries is a highly established writer in England. And then, like, within 10 pages, I'd say, I was drawn in because I realized that there was way more going on than I would have ever expected. There were aspects about Diana that I didn't know about. And then the more I read, the more I realized that what I had at hand was like a universal love story, a timeless universal love story, which is something I always wanted to do, because it's something that's not done anymore these days, really. It's like, in a way, it's a bit of an old-fashioned genre, if you know what I mean?
So did you, and the love story comes through very strongly in the movie, and so obviously that was something that you've very much latched onto, but in terms of Diana's story, you say that you didn't really know much about it prior to receiving the script, but you're from Germany. What is her place in the country where you come from? Is there a big consciousness of her there?
I think you find that consciousness all over the world, funny enough, and the Germans were fascinated with her and still are, but as we are not a monarchy, it's a bit of a spectacle as well, right? To see the royals. For us, it's a bit like a zoo, yeah. And within that zoo, I think people saw Diana as a real person, somebody they could relate to, something that it made her that icon, really, because she had a directness and an honesty about her that you wouldn't find in the rest of the bunch there.
Yeah. Now, obviously, Naomi spoke to I'm sure many people that were close to Diana. But you, in terms of director, did you seek out people as well to give you a bigger sense of who she was?
Well, I talked to as many people as possible. I mean, I did my research with reading, and then watching all the videos that I could get my hands on. But then I spoke to former confidants, and as well to people who just, you know, had met her, and had just like a brief moment, and even like, you know, anti-royalists who happened to come across her when she was like handing out like an award or something like that. It was very interesting because they, each one had to admit that even if they didn't want to, were impressed and charmed by her, actually, and surprised about her wit and intelligence.
Mm. And you really do get the sense in the movie, too, that once she breaks free of the monarchy, once she breaks free of Charles, and she begins to really find herself. I mean, it's even more than a love story. It's really about a woman finding her place in the world.
Yes, that's the astonishing other thing that I found out. It really seems that, you know, she had been deprived of love from the very early stages of her childhood on. Her mother left her when she wasn't even seven. So that's a devastating experience for a child, and it's very hard to, you know, to gain trust again into the human, you know, in relations and all that. She finds Charles and she falls in love with him, only to realize that the same thing happens again, right? He turns his back against her, cheating on her, and all his friends are in on it, and she's left there like that little child again, and and she has so much love in her. She always had that. Finally finding that love transforms her. It gives me hope, because it tells me that even if that love didn't work out or had so many conflicts that they didn't know where to take it without it being their fault, it is such a powerful energy that it can make a person reinvent herself. It's fascinating.
And also another thing that the movie does very well is portray what it must have been like to exist as the most famous woman on the planet. I mean, there's such a sense of isolation there, and her desperate to break free from that. Was that a big challenge to dramatize?
Well, I always wanted it to be. I think we achieved it. For me, it was very important that the whole film sort of energy-wise resembled her existence to a certain extent, which means a general loneliness, something very melancholic and sad in a way. I think it throughout the film that sort of energy is there. And I think we succeeded, and I heard that from many people who had seen the film. Who appreciated that, actually.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And you, I'm sure that you shot this in England. Because she's so revered there, was that helpful to shoot in that environment?
It helped me quite a bit. Of course, I couldn't shoot in the actual palaces. The royals don't let anybody in there, regardless which film you're shooting. But I needed that energy. London is a very specific place. It's the center of the UK, and it's been like the capital of an empire, and it radiates that energy, and it needed that. And at the same time, I tried to depict London like not in the, you know, the postcardish kind of way that many films do. Yet I wanted to get the true energy of the place. I hope I did.
You absolutely did, yeah. But I know that, you know, I would imagine that shooting in an environment in which she's so revered, and she's such a public figure, if there was a skepticism among the Brits that you sensed as you were shooting, or if they were embracing of the prospect?
Well, I think no. Like the people on the street, they pretty much embraced that aspect. They found it fascinating, and I must say, it is very tricky to shoot in London. The authorities don't really make it easy on you. But once you're shooting in the streets, people are incredibly helpful and very friendly and very curious. So, no, that was good. It was very pleasuresome, actually.
Another thing that I'm curious about, because with Downfall, obviously, that was a film you made about concerning Hitler, and now we're on the opposite end of the spectrum with a great humanitarian like Diana. What are the major challenges of associated with bringing someone's life onto the screen, with being fair, but also very open-eyed to their flaws?
Well, the challenge is to get it right as much as you can. So I do my research, thorough research. I hear an interesting detail that supposedly has happened, then I have to counter-check that. And if I don't find at least like two different accounts that state that has happened, I can't use it. So bit by bit, you sort of get closer to what the reality was like. And at the same time, like when telling a love story based on true events, of course you have to invent, because there was nobody there in the bedroom. You cannot, use any sources there. Sometimes there's descriptions about certain incidents that have happened, or like general descriptions about how they dealt with each other. But from a certain point on, you just have to become the artist who invents. And in doing that, you try to sort of hit the spirit of the relationship, or match the spirit of the character based on all the things you know and you feel.
It's still possible you might be queen one day.
It's all right, me coming here.
Charles and I live separate lives.
It's not going to be possible for you and I to go anywhere without a million people swarming all over us.
I'm a princess and I get what I want.
Cover yourself with this blanket and lie down in the back.
She says that you are a young lioness.
I want to tell you something confidential.
There's been a rumor.
Pakistani heart surgeon.
Sir, are you doing a divorce?
How did you get this number?
Divorce?
How did you get this number?
We can't simply be a man and a woman.
But you must have known that from the start.
I haven't the faintest idea how to manage this maelstrom that you have created.
Members of your staff feel that they've been exposed to an element of danger.
You've received an invitation from Holy Fire.
Say yes.
Hasnat, it's me. I really want you to call me.
What's happening?
Looking right at you.
Did you get some more shots?
Oh, yeah. Plenty.
Good.
What is she up to?
I can't seem to live without you.
They always say that when they're saying goodbye. The government minister has called you a loose cannon.
Diana! This is Diana. I can't take your call right now. Please leave a message.
Okay, that was Oliver Hirschbegel. The film is titled Diana. It is currently in limited release. Big news that came out last week, the closing of the 300 remaining Blockbuster video stores. Yes, there are still 300 out there. By the new year, they'll all be closed. I actually, when I read about this, the first thing I did was call my local Blockbuster, which I guess a lot of people did, and I asked them what the discounts on their Blu-rays were. And they're only at 25% off at that point. But apparently they're going to start their liquidation sale this coming Friday. So, you might get some good deals. There's two schools of thought on this. The first one is people that have warm feelings about Blockbuster, because most people that weren't within the vicinity of a specialty video rental store. I mean, they were only in the vicinity of a Blockbuster. Have cherished memories of renting movies from there. The second school of thought is, you know, Blockbuster was the Walmart that put all the mom and pops out of business, and we've always hated them.
Yeah. I'm more of that school of thought. And also, they didn't carry anything. They never carried Last Temptation of Christ, right? That was...
Right.
No. And they also edited a lot of their, you know, the R-rated movies that I heard. I mean, I never went there. We had Errol's, and then Errol's became Potomac Video, and Potomac actually had a really good selection, and we did have mom-and-pop video stores. I only went to Blockbuster if it was something I couldn't... I mean, I remember I went... Ironically, to find some movies I couldn't find anywhere else, like Cabaret Balkan or Full Tilt Boogie or some older movies that they did have that the other stores didn't have. But it was very rare that I went to a Blockbuster in my lifetime. Very rare.
I would go there a lot, actually.
I actually worked in a Blockbuster for 6 months. So
they must have hated you.
That was quite unusual because I had been... used to working in independently owned video stores.
Right, right. Kim's Video.
Some better than others. Yeah, Kim's Video being one of them, but that was after my Blockbuster experience. But also, you know, Video Room up in New York and also World of Video up in New York and then Videodrome here in Atlanta as well, which is still in existence.
Scarecrow in Seattle is still in existence, and they're having trouble.
There's still a few, and they're going to continue to have trouble, obviously. But, my feelings about Blockbuster are kind of mixed, actually. I mean, like, as a worker there, I was told not to speak to customers about their rental choices and not to recommend movies to them either. So most of my work experience at a Blockbuster was not as sunny as some people portray their work experiences in this time period of mourning or whatever for the
right family. Right.
It was mostly just busy work. And we were extremely busy. It was an extremely busy store, so it was mostly just getting the things back out on the shelves and ringing up customers, and that was it. And there was no room for talking about quality of movies. There was when it was time to get movies off of the new shelf and put them on the old shelves, you know, in the middle of the store, absolutely everything was up for grabs. That means that they could delete titles that you think every video store should have, like The Godfather or whatever. They would go ahead and delete, oh, let's get rid of this piece of junk. We don't need The Godfather. We don't need Casablanca or Gone with the Wind, Godfather, all that stuff goes out the window. You know, they were happy to do that in order to make some room for the new UA Bowl movie or whatever. So it was like, it was very unforgiving, and for me, just working at a Blockbuster was just like, oh my God, they're just deleting all of movie history here and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it made me kind of not like that organization very much, even less so than I did before I agreed to work with them, and I agreed to work with them really just to have the experience of working with a corporate video store. Really,
right, right.
To see how it worked, really. It was kind of research in some ways, but I also do have empathy for those people who look at Blockbuster as being, you know, the video store that was in their neighborhood in the middle of towns that didn't have independent video stores, and so I can totally understand that, you know.
Oh, of course.
It is a large amount of people's sort of formative experience as to what the video store experience offered, which was, but to say that is, I mean, really, they didn't really get what really video, the great video stores offered. I mean, like things like Kim's or Videodrome, the ones that I worked at and ones that are all around the country, you know, that whole, the whole thing of like of real true customer service was really at those stores, you know, real true like regular customers coming in, you know, the clerk knows what you like, knows when something new comes in that, oh, this customer will really like this. I have to remember to recommend this to them, and so forth and so on. That's the kind of things that the mom-and-pop stores, which were really movie-centric, offered that were the best, you know. The death of Blockbuster really offers us an opportunity to recognize the death of the video store in general.
Blockbuster wasn't the place for cinephiles to feed their addiction necessarily. But
no, it really wasn't. It was maybe to begin the addiction, but certainly not to sustain it.
I would go there often to rent new stuff, but because their old stuff was very slim pickings here. There's also, I mean, obviously the sadness of a few thousand people losing their job, which is never a good thing.
That's the big thing. That's the important thing.
Mm-hmm.
But also, a friend of mine and listener to the show, it's forwarded me an article about, you know, the death of Blockbuster also accentuates the death of movies as a product. In terms of, well, on one level, the collection of movies, are we losing that?
I think so. I think that is happening. You know, I mean, I can look at my own. I mean, I sit here and look. I'm looking at my collection of movies right now, and they're pretty dusty. And the reason for that is, I don't really take a lot of hard copies out and take a look at them anymore. I really don't have to. I don't really need to do that, not with the computer.
It's true with bookstores too, though. Look what's happening in the bookstores all over the world. I mean, this is all not just, and record stores for that matter. It's sad. It is very sad.
And bookstores too. I mean, like I have a theory that a lot of the current woes that we have with employment and so forth has a lot to do with the death of these kind of stores, you know, these stores that sold media, because the people who worked at those stores, they worked at them because they were artists in that kind of medium, or if they were working in bookstores, they were maybe writers, or if they were working at movie stores, they were film enthusiasts or filmmakers, record stores, they were musicians, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the death of these kind of stores, I think, is, you know, has really left a lot of those people that liked working in those atmospheres and really never envisioned themselves working in any other atmospheres, has really left them out in a lurch. And I think that's one of the reasons that there's an employment problem, is because there's no place for these kind of people to go anymore. I mean, now these kind of people have to take up something else. They have to take up working at a restaurant or dig a ditch or be a plumber or something like that, you know, which you can't do very easily. So it's kind of left them out hanging in the wind. Now I speak for myself on that too. I cannot picture myself working at any. It's very difficult for me to picture myself working in any other place other than a video store, movie theater, record store, and I'm talking about, you know, lower-end jobs. You know, I can picture myself doing other jobs, but you know, these kind of, like, minimum wage kind of jobs, these are the ones that I really liked, and I can't see myself doing anything else, really, you know.
Well, I remember, I mean, there were two places where, because I used to be crazy about collecting Laserdiscs, so there are two places that sold them out of town here, and, you know, you'd go there, and the cashiers would really know their stuff, and I'd pre-order stuff, and then they'd call me and say, it's in, and I'd have a special day when I drive out of town, and I'd take it from the cashier and pay for it, and it was like this priceless jewel that I was looking at.
Right.
And I could unwrap it, and I couldn't wait to get home. And, you know, that whole sensation is gone.
Mm-hmm. I hate it.
Yeah.
I hate that.
Yeah.
I hate that. The closest thing that you have now, or at least that I have now, is finding stuff online, you know. It's like, oh, shit, this is out now. Oh, that's great. I can finally watch this now.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's not the same thing. It's like I don't know, something about the ease of it all has taken some of the joy of getting something.
It is, and Jerry, you and I talked about this when you posted a picture of peaches or something.
Yeah.
You know, the ability to browse is gone. The ability to go in a store and leisurely browse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just different online. Just like it's different reading a newspaper online than it is actually physically holding a paper in your hand.
Right.
You know?
And all of those differences, I think, you know, in the newspaper analogy and also, to the video store thing, has to do with the ability to run into something that you had no idea existed. In
exactly.
Other words, you know, it's just like, and I mean, you know, same thing with the newspaper. It's like when you're holding a newspaper and you've got six stories on each page, you know, to compete for your attention, you can find something that you weren't necessarily looking for.
Exactly.
And that's the thing about the video store too, is finding things that you weren't necessarily looking for. Running into something and say, you know what, I'll give this a shot. I've never heard of this director or I've never heard of this movie, but I'm going to give this a shot because it's appealing to me right now. And then that can lead you into another world here in the in the world with the internet here and everything, with all these algorithms going on, trying to predict what you're going to like and so forth. They can lead you to something. They can lead you to some things, but they're based on an algorithm. They're based on what you've been doing previously.
Yeah.
So you're just going to get more of the same. You're not going to break out of your world and try and find something that's different, forge a new path for yourself in the discovery of an art form. I just think that's the biggest thing that we're losing with the loss of all of these kinds of stores, and the loss of the printed word. Really,
I think the closest thing we have in this area, as far as bookstores, we have the famous Politics and Prose. But the thing I was thinking about is, when you mentioned bookstores and everything, what we used to do, and when even working at Borders or Barnes and Noble, is you'd have staff recommendations. As much as I love Amazon for their prices and everything, don't get me wrong, I do like Amazon.com. But let's be very honest, those staff selections, whether they be books or music or movies, you know, those made all the difference. Because you would
they
get
do.
Something, like you said, you would get something I did not know about that. Wow, let me check this out. Those staff selections, whether they be books, music, CDs, or, you know, movies, are a big, those things would tip people into, as you said, a new direction. Very big. Very big thing. They made or break sales for someone who was no one had ever heard of. So that's a very important thing, and you don't get that online so much with the bigger, like an Amazon or something. And I'm not going to, but I don't want to, you know, Amazon's like the ultimate double-edged sword because it's made everything incredibly convenient,
but it put everyone else out of business. And that's not good. There was a price to be, there was a price, and that was the, and the price is everything that we've just lost.
Well, I mean, that's the price of the internet. It's the price of having the internet is losing all this stuff that, that we liked. And it's not a pleasant loss. I mean, it's just not.
At the same time, you know, there are, there is a market, relatively small but apparently growing, for something like record albums again. I mean,
oh yeah, that is coming back, definitely. Slowly, but it is it is there. There is a market for vinyl, no doubt about it.
Yeah, so I'm still waiting for the Laserdisc to come back.
I love
that
vinyl.
But you never hear that. You never hear that about Laserdisc. It's like just the purity of the Laserdisc is so much better than the DVD or the Blu-ray. You know,
that's
different.
But
there
is something with the Laserdisc, right? I mean, there was something in the sense that they had more space to in a Laserdisc to hold you know, information.
You know,
so
I think the storage facility on a Blu-ray is infinitely better, it felt more like a collector's item, a Laserdisc.
Mm-hmm.
It was shaped like an album. It looked better on the better in the cabinet. You know, it was more impressive and bulkier. It just, you know, felt more of weight. You know,
I mean, you still have libraries and everything, and you do have still Barnes and Noble, but I think Barnes and Noble in a couple of years.
That's a good point out, by the way. Libraries, that's something that's not going to die anytime soon, I don't think.
I hope not, but you never know.
You never know in these days. But libraries would still be the number one place to go for the video store experience if you've never experienced it. You know,
right?
It's still out there for you to kind of, and the thing is, there's no late fees. You can keep them for a week, at least here in Atlanta, so that's good.
Well, I've kept some of mine for years. Okay. We'll be back, all of us will be back next Sunday talking about movie posters, and then this Wednesday we'll post our show on the new John Sayles movie with John Sayles and I think Edward James Olmos. They're going to try to get Edward James Olmos for us, so that'll be a door.
I've interviewed both of those guys before. I interviewed John Sayles back in 84 or 85 or something for Brother from Another Planet, and then Edward James Olmos I interviewed back in whenever Stand and Deliver came out.
Mm-hmm. That's 87 or 88, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'll be interesting.
Well, I only got to spend 10 minutes with Sayles this time. The first time we talked to him for like half hour.
Half hour for like Honey Dripper. That's right.
Honey Dripper. That was the name of my favorite stripper. Okay. We'll be back next Sunday, and then the Sunday after that will be the JFK show, and then we'll do a holiday gift guide. Tell you, we'll have some interviews with some people that have new books and movies and such that you can think about purchasing for Black Friday.
That's right, Black Friday. Oh God, that's all coming up.
We'll close with John Williams' Book Thief theme.